This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your We Wiped His Nose Just Like He Had Him a Cold of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Use this gospel for protection. It's a hard road to heaven. We call on your blessings. In the Father, we put our faith. King of the kingdom, our demons are trembling. Holy angels defending. In the Father, we put our faith.
You're listening to Use This Gospel from the new Kanye album, which is called Jesus is King. If you have been living under a rock, you may not know that Kanye West has made a turn towards God and religious music in the last few months. Since January, he has been hosting Sunday service, originally near his home in Calabasas, and more recently on the road. He's got a top-notch choir doing choral and gospel arrangements of pop hits and R&B songs, and also playing religious music. Now, obviously, Kanye's turn to gospel has been met with a lot of skepticism, especially given some of the more provocative and unfortunate political stances that he has taken in the last couple of years. But what you can certainly say about the last 8 to 9 months is it really does mark a true standalone era for Kanye West. Initially, it was unclear if it was going to be sort of dabbling, something that he would be doing on the side. But it's become clear, especially in the last 3 months, I think, with Jesus is King the album, Jesus is King the film, and the continuing of the Sunday services, that this is a hard turn for Kanye West. Now, if you ask me, I think Kanye has been doing bits and pieces of what you see in 2019 Kanye. He's been doing it since the beginning. There's always been some of this in Kanye. When I was writing about the album and film, I tried to underscore the fact that worship music, praise music, this is something that's always been part of the Kanye West proposition, even if he was the person that he himself was praising. And obviously, if you go all the way to Yeezus, talking about I am a God, things of that nature, it's always been there. But also, the soul music traditions that he drew on from the earliest parts of his career are very intimately tied to the gospel tradition in America. So him returning to gospel, quote-unquote returning, is maybe not as radical a shift as it seems. It's become increasingly difficult to talk about Kanye West disentangled from politics. It's totally reasonable. I found myself, especially in recent weeks, very curious about how this moment in Kanye West's public art life was being received in the gospel world. Because online, there's a tremendous amount of skepticism. But what I do see are people who are saying they believe that his turn to faith is sincere. And so I wondered how people in the gospel community were receiving this music, this shift, the film, these Sunday services, so on and so forth. So on this week's podcast, we're going to have two conversations with gospel music experts. First, we're going to hear from Hassan James. Hassan is the publisher and editor of Root Magazine, which is a publication that covers contemporary gospel music, a little bit more youth and millennial focused. And Hassan is going to talk about how this era in Kanye is being received in the contemporary gospel community. And then after Hassan, we're going to call Bob Maravich. And Bob is a gospel music historian. He's written a book about the history of gospel music in Chicago, runs a website called the Journal of Gospel Music. And Bob has been thinking about the kind of pendulum swings between sacred and secular for decades and been an observer and a chronicler of that space. And I was most interested to speak to Bob about the historical antecedents of what Kanye is doing. It sometimes seems that when Kanye makes a big gesture like this, it exists in a vacuum. But of course, that's not true. For years and for decades, popular artists have either turned towards religious music or religious artists have stepped out into the popular sphere. And so Bob is going to talk about that, as well as where Kanye's current music fits in the current landscape of holy hip hop, gospel rap, so on and so forth. First up, Hassan James is calling in. Hassan, what's good, man?
Hey, what's up, John? How are you, man?
I'm great. Hassan is the publisher and editor of Root Magazine, and we first talked a few years ago. I was writing a piece on Bree Babineau and Kalante Gavin and all the Marquise Boone Enterprises situation, and that's when we first met. So when I knew I was pulling together a podcast about how the gospel world is thinking about this moment in Kanye, I knew we had to get you on. So thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
One thing that I know that we talked about a little bit offline is, in addition to obviously what you do in gospel, you grew up in the Bronx. Hip hop is very important to you. So just obviously engaging with an idea like this, there are a lot of people, I think, who work in gospel media, especially old school gospel media, for whom this is just a DQ right off the stop. You know, like this is just, there's just no, we're not even going to talk about this. But that's not how you feel.
Not at all. Growing up in the Bronx, you know, you live, you breathe hip hop music, especially, you know, I'm 43 years old. So I grew up in an era, late 80s, early 90s, where it was just heavy. And then, you know, I grew up on the block where it started, on Cedric Avenue. So it was just like hip hop everywhere. But I also grew up in church. So I had the best of both worlds. So that's actually kind of how I started Root Magazine, because I didn't see anything that spoke to me, like the contemporary church kid who loved hip hop. So that's why I created Root Magazine, which is kind of like that contemporary piece in the gospel world. So
it's worth adding, before we even get onto Kanye specifically, Let's talk a little bit about the last 5 to 10 years in gospel music. And I feel like what you see are obviously an increase in the presence of gospel rap, but also more centrist gospel artists, but who are embracing textures from hip hop and R&B. And, you know, obviously that's been happening since Kirk Franklin, but it also feels maybe more present now than at any point previously.
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. We have a lot of the younger artists now who are actually leading the charge within gospel music, like actually Breanna Babineau. She's back out with a new single. She's looking really like Beyonce-ish on the cover. So that's very inviting with stuff like that you wouldn't see back in the days. You also have like Tasha Cobbs, who is this young millennial who has like 4 albums on the Billboard Gospel charts right now. Of course, Kirk Franklin is still, after 25
still
years,
doing it.
You got Travis Green, and then you have Lecrae and his whole camp, who I just saw at the Dove Awards. They just smashed the Dove Awards. So it is this kind of this fusion of gospel mixed with contemporary. It's a new, I guess, leaders of the new school type of thing that's going on.
And it causes tension, because I feel like every time I see an interview with Kirk Franklin, I did an interview with Kirk Franklin a couple of years ago and this came up, but every time I read something with him, you know, he just talks about how difficult it has been for him at various points in his career from the gospel vanguard, from the old school, who do not approve of either the style of music he is making or the overtures that he's making outside of the gospel music audience, the traditional gospel music audience. That's still alive.
It's still alive somewhat. See, the thing is, it's almost like the gospel industry music is changing, almost like the church culture is changing. Okay. Because now the way people even consume church, people go to church online now. Mm-hmm. People are not flocking to a specific church on Sundays with the 3-piece suit. People are going to churches with their jeans on, with hats on. So Jordans. You have these contemporary churches now. So it's almost like the gospel industry has to have that same type of acceptance and that same concept. So it's not what it once was like 5-10 years ago. So it's changing a little bit.
So I would think, if that's the case, then Kanye putting out a record like Jesus is King, doing these Sunday services, might have a warmer reception than he would have had if he was doing this 5 or 10 years ago. Has that been the case?
So in looking on social media and in talking with different friends, even me attending the Sunday service and seeing, I think the reception has been good. You have some people who are just, they're going to be who they are. They look at church a certain way. And anything outside of that box, they're not trying to hear it. You do have those people. But for the most part, these millennials, they are with him. They're enjoying the music. They're enjoying the movement. I think what's getting in the way of it is his politics. I think that's where some people are just like, okay, what is this? Is it an agenda? And it can kind of seem like that.
Now, obviously, there is a popular perception that if you look at the last 2-3 years of Kanye's public life, he's had this very vocal support for President Trump. President Trump has embraced a lot of policies that are inhospitable to black people, to poor people, to all kinds of marginalized groups in our society. So Kanye embracing him, even while saying at the same time, I don't agree with all his policies, but still embracing him, has been for many a bridge too far that they can't, independent of the gospel part, just you know, circa 12 months ago, there are plenty of people who are like, nah, we're off this. We just can't, we're not going to deal with this. And that the perception from a lot of those people is that him turning to gospel is, number one, a cleansing of his public image. Number two, a way to re-ingratiate himself, especially with black audiences. And I wonder if you personally see it that way, and also if the conversations that you've been having with folks in the industry, if that's how it's generally being received.
I really think that Kanye is on this path to righteousness.
You think it's sincere? You believe the sincerity of it?
I do. But Kanye being Kanye, he still has to go left a little bit. So it's just not like I've received Christ, I'm this changed creature, you know, maybe I shouldn't say certain things. It's still, I'm going to be Kanye West. I am changed. The Lord has changed me. But yet, yeah, you can't tell me who to vote for. Like, right. That's a form of slavery.
Right.
So it's like this two parts. And my thing is like, just like, you know, Trump, certain things you say for the kitchen table. Certain things you don't have to say everything. You know what I mean?
But that's never been yay. That's the thing, is it's never been yay.
That's never been yay. So it's just like, okay, do we just accept this? I'm the type of person where I can kind of separate the two.
Yeah.
Like even engaging with, you know, his musical director back and forth on Facebook. My thing was just like, bro, we got to say that this dude, certain things he needs to say. And he needs to be held accountable for.
Right. And so just to explain what you're referring to. So a couple days ago on Facebook, you had a conversation, an impromptu conversation, not like a interview, but like an impromptu conversation. Tell the people with who you were talking.
Well, basically Phil the Keys, who is basically his musical director. He plays for Kanye and his choir. He's a very skilled musician out of L.A., and I don't even know how this happened. I think I was on my friend's post, and I just was like, oh, my God, Kanye again. Like, he's fucking out. He's not well. And then he was like, what do you mean by that? And then I just let him know, like, you know, certain things that he says he should not say, although the album is dope. But, like, come on, man. Like, just chill on that. And he's just like, no, people don't understand him. He's misunderstood. They're taking his comments out of context. So these people that he's with, they're definitely riding with him, and rightfully so. But I just feel like it needs to be somebody in the camp, much like Trump, that needs to be like, you know what, you shouldn't say that. Like, chill on the politics, because we're very sensitive when it comes to that type of stuff. The church and the African-American community.
Okay, so basically, it's not as if Kanye is trying to make an album in a genre that would otherwise be hospitable to Trump support. I mean, that seems pretty self-evident, but, it, you know, we should at least acknowledge that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. So from a musician perspective, like, obviously he's been doing these Sunday services. We have this choir and band that all seem to be playing at an incredibly high level. The people that he's playing with or chose to bring into his orbit are those mm-hmm. people who have credibility in the space.
Yes. There's a lot. There's a few singers in that choir that I know personally. That can really sing. There are musicians. from what I hear, they all get paid very well. When Kanye goes to these churches, he leaves a hefty offering. So it's not like he's just doing this just to be doing it and it's a bunch of lackeys just following him. This is a production, which is almost like in the number of maybe $1 million a month.
I would love to know the numbers because they've got to be astronomical, the costs.
Yeah, it's
right?
$1 million a month. It's $1 million a month. And I got that from a very close source. So, I mean, that's what makes me think. Like, he means business. Like,
yes.
This is no foolishness. Like, he really means this. It's just the other side of it. But the music, you cannot deny it. The man is a genius, man. It's almost like a mixture of College Dropout meets Late Registration meets The Life of Pablo. Like, just because it's gospel, he didn't pull any punches when it came to the content and to the production of it all.
And to be fair, this is something, I mean, we should probably play a little bit of Jesus Walks right now. This is something he's wanted to engage with since early in his career, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So let's play a second of Jesus Walks just for context.
We at war. We at war with terrorism, racism, but most of all, we at war with ourselves. God, show me the way because the devil's trying to break me down. You know what the Midwest is, young and restless, but restless might snatch your necklace, and next these might jack your Lexus. Somebody tell these who Kanye West is. I walk through the valley of the shadow where death is. Top floor, if you alone and leave you breathless. Try to catch it, it's kinda hard getting choked by the Texas. Yeah, and I check the method. They be asking us questions, harassing, arrest us, saying we eat pieces of like you for breakfast, huh? Y'all eat pieces of what's the basis? We ain't going nowhere but got suits and cases. A trunk full of coke, rental car from Avis. My mama used to say only Jesus could save us. Well, mama, I know I act the fool, but I'll be gone to November. I got packs to move. I hope
God. So since the beginning of Ye's career, really, he has wanted to find ways to incorporate this kind of subject matter. But obviously, Kanye in 2000, you know, 5 or 6, that's a big difference from Kanye in like 2009, 2011. A lot's changed. So he was walking away from that path. You know, I happen to think 808s is like sort of a devotional record in a strange way. Obviously, it's not a religious record, but it does feel devotional to me in texture. But in terms of explicitly religious content, he didn't really return to that until Pablo. So you see the seeds of what Jesus is King became, you see it in the Pablo era, right? I mean, I'm sure that must have spoken to you as well at the time.
Oh, absolutely. I felt it, man. I'm just like, aside from it being, you know, only 27 minutes, I got that feeling like, wow, it's like this is old Kanye. Like, this is the Kanye we've been wanting to hear. And then to have the whole, you know, religious aspect of it, but still giving you great lyrical content. You know, Aretha Franklin is like the biggest artist, you know, especially soul artist, you know, number one in a lot of lists and things of that nature. But a lot of people don't know her biggest album to date is Amazing Grace. Like, that sold the most. So we've always had this kind of fascination with religion and with gospel music. And not just people who go to church, people outside of church bought that record.
Oh, of course. And that's how it's going to be. That's how this record's going to function, obviously.
Exactly. 38 million streams in 12 hours. That's nuts. And that's why I say he's a genius, because 27 minutes, you can listen to this on the way home like two times. So that's why he got those streams.
Also, you brought up something that was on my mind and I was thinking of including in the piece I wrote, but I kind of just didn't have the time to really get to it. But I'm glad you brought it up because it reminded me of it. So this record does feel like it has some of that early Kanye texture, that early inherited to soul music texture. Now, obviously, it has some later Kanye, like Yeezus and De Pablo era, but it does have some of that early Kanye. And I thought it was striking that Kanye, from the very beginning of his career, was always making an argument for himself as part of a very, very long tradition of black soul music. Maybe not explicitly black church music, but black soul music. He always, whether through his sample choices and through the textures of his songs, was always implicitly placing himself in that conversation. Now, what I would say is in the late 2000s and the early 2010s, as he's tried to be as maximalist as possible, that wasn't always as present in those albums.
No.
Jesus is King, to me, feels like an explicit reintroduction of that version of Kanye. And it's interesting that it comes at the time where Kanye's relationship with the Black community is as fraught as it's ever been. Because I think making a gospel record is, yes, a form of, I don't want to say penitence, but it is a form of trying to clean up a public image, perhaps. But to me, the actual gesture that is the penitent gesture is the, actually, I still make records like the old Kanye made records. That, to me, is like the real, that's the secret whisper on this album. It's not the God content, it's the structure.
It's the structure, yeah. I didn't think about it that way, but you're absolutely right, because you didn't hear that on 808 and Heartbreak.
Right. You don't hear it on Yeezus. You hear it a little bit on Ye, but not really. But to me, I was so struck after listening to this record, I was kind of like, this record feels really effective in the way an old Kanye record feels effective. The fact that it's about God, not that it's secondary, but there were so many structural parallels that I was hearing to the first two Kanye records. And I was like, oh, really? He's trying to trigger people to remember that version of Kanye. It felt like an internal callback. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Almost like sampling yourself in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Generally speaking, do you feel that Kanye making music of this nature is welcome in the gospel community?
So to a certain extent, yes. However, I'm on two radio stations, and I can guarantee you one of those stations, it won't be in rotation. Just because they're really no hip hop. We don't really play any hip hop at all. The other one may.
Is it a gospel station exclusively, the other station?
It is. It is, but they're a little more liberal.
So would that station play gospel rap and things of that nature?
Some, yes. There's stations that just won't play it. Like I know on Kirk Franklin's Craze on Sirius, I heard it all weekend. Like they played a number of songs. But it's still an uphill battle with even gospel rap in on gospel radio. That's an uphill battle still in 2019. You hear the gospel hip hop on internet radio and, you know, those stations like that. But for the most part, like Lecrae and those guys, they get most of their support, to be honest, from the white Christian community.
Is that true? Is that really how it works?
That's how it works.
Wow.
That's how it works. Yeah. It's so crazy.
Well, yeah, because you just said you saw him on the Dove Awards. For our listeners who don't know, that's the award ceremony that covers both black gospel and Christian contemporary music. It's not the Stellar Awards, which is a different thing. That's Jacqueline Carr, Tasha Cobbs, like that's all that.
I have seen hip hop one time on the Stellar Awards a couple years back, and I was actually shocked. They gave him a whole set. Yeah, it was like The Truth, Lecrae, and a couple others.
Now, Kirk survived, right? You know, Kirk managed to, you know, still extremely relevant, and he was going through this in the 90s. You know, everybody remembers the big Vibe cover in the Stomp era. Let's all get up and dance for 20 seconds of Stomp by Kirk Franklin and God's Property.
For those of you that think that gospel music has gone too far, you think we've gotten too radical with our message. Well, I got news for you. You ain't heard nothing yet. And if you don't know, now you know. Glory, glory! Woo! You better put them hands together. And act like you know up in here. Cheek peek!
Lately I've been going through some things that's really got me down.
Put your hands together. Come on!
I need someone, somebody to help me come and turn my life around.
I feel like having some church up in here. Come on! Chat.
I can't explain it. I can't obtain it.
How did Kirk survive it?
Kirk survived it because Kirk is... his writing, man, you cannot deny his writing. And although he gave you a Stomp, he still gave you, you know, It's Over Now or Smile or, you know, those songs that pull at your heartstrings.
Right. And also appeal to an older demographic, I'm sure.
Of course. And then once you see him in concert or on tour, he's charismatic. But Kirk Franklin comes around once in a lifetime. He's our, you know, James Cleveland, if you will. Like, he's the GOAT. So he survived it.
But not everybody could take all those hits, basically, and still
go. Not everybody could.
So in a way, because obviously, you know, we should play a little bit of the Kirk part on Ultralight Beam. So let's listen to that for a second.
Father, this prayer's for everyone that feels they're not good enough. This prayer's for everybody that feels that they're too messed up. For everyone that feels they said I'm sorry too many times. You can never go too far when you can't come back home again. That's why I need...
You know, when I heard Ultralight Beam and I heard this Kirk part, is, you know, just incredibly moving, devastating, frankly, benediction towards the end of that song. I'm sure Kirk took flack for that, and that's to be expected. But based on what you're saying, I would have assumed Kirk would have been the soft entry for Kanye to experiment with gospel. But if people are already skeptical of Kirk, maybe they see what Kirk's doing with Ye as not a bridge. They're saying it is a complete outlier that they don't have to pay attention to. Is that how it was received at the time?
There's a group that felt that way. But because we have these millennials now who are very boisterous and vocal, especially with social media, it was more of a, we kind of like this.
Sure.
And because Kirk is already 25, 27 years in, like, he's not getting much flack for anything anymore.
Point.
Anything he kind of says.
Yeah, he's certified.
There you go. He's certified.
Let's talk a little bit about the younger current generation of gospel musicians who seem to have a much higher comfort level with hip hop. So, you know, I think Corin Hawthorne did a record with Yella Beezy. Nicki Minaj got on a Tasha record. To me, it seems like that's happening more now than at any time previously. Is that safe to say?
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely safe to say. Yep.
So if those people are welcome into the gospel universe, you know, the rappers are being welcome, are there obstacles for Kanye being welcomed into the gospel ecosystem? Could he arrive on his own terms? Would someone have to actively invite him? You know, does he have to get on a Jacqueline Carr record? Like, does he have to get on a, you know, an Anthony Brown record? Like, is that something that has to happen? Or could he arrive and be welcomed on his own terms?
I think at this point, he potentially could arrive and do this on his own terms. I mean, the numbers have proven that. The Sunday services have proven that. It's not just people from the outside coming to these services. These are church people.
Right.
People who attend church every Sunday at their own churches or whatever. The church has pretty much embraced Kanye West. So I think he could kind of go to his own beat. But again, you know, we're up for another election next year. Just that quick. And I'm curious to see if he's going to keep this same energy and this same stance and still be accepted.
You think there's a chance we'll see Kanye on the Stellars or not?
I think it's something that they're probably working on right now. Remember with Jesus Walk, it was a big thing where him even being nominated. And I think ultimately he didn't get the nomination, but because they were in an uproar back then, because I think it had some cursing in it. So it was just like, no. But this is different. This is pure gospel hip hop. So I don't know if he can be denied now. And I think if they want their show to be hot, they better get him.
In addition to the recent overtures that have been happening in the gospel community towards hip hop, there's also, you know, you look at Chance the Rapper. Chance the Rapper is, in many respects, a gospel rapper. Not exclusively,
absolutely.
but obviously, you know, religion is central to his value proposition. It's one of the things that people connect to about him. Even that guy, NF, who's that white rapper, kind of sounds like Eminem, but, you know, he's basically quasi-Christian. You know, he's a Christian rapper, in essence.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not that music with spiritual content can't be widely popular. Like, that's, we know that that's obviously not true. It's really a question of, are people who are in the communities who are primarily preoccupied with spiritual music, with worship music, praise music, etc., whether there is an openness in those communities to bring in someone like a Chance or someone like a Kanye and say, okay, we know that not 100% of what you do is this, but you are, you know, you're walking the path, and we want to either support or embrace you as you do that.
We have to look at the bright side of this. Like, when people download this on Spotify, Apple, iTunes, when you listen to this music, man, it's a thing at the bottom that you may also like, which they, at this point now is going to be another gospel album. So this can help gospel music across the board. So we got to look at it, man. You know, people are going to have eyes on gospel music and not look at it as this corny music just for church people.
Right. With that in mind, here's a question. When you hear the music on this album, like the actual music, the arrangements, the choir, does it remind you of anything in the gospel music industry? Are there people who are making records? Obviously, Kanye is always going to sound like Kanye. We talked about that already. But like, are there artists who these structures remind you of? I think about a Dietrich Haddon, a Ty Tribbett, a Tone at the time that Tone was really popping. Like just playing kind of texturally.
So out of those people you just named, the closest thing is it would be Ty Tribbett. Because when Ty came, it was, whoa. Like we hadn't really heard anything like that in gospel music, especially with a choir. I mean, what he was doing with certain samples and things of that nature, that whole movement. I think Ty would be the closest.
Is there a good Ty Tribbett song we should go out with?
He has a song called Good in the Hood.
Yo, brother, this has been great. I really appreciate you showing up and speaking so frankly about all this stuff.
Oh, yeah, man. This is great talk.
All right, let's go out with Ty Tribbett, Good in the Hood.
This be Ty Tribbett. Good in the hood. And whatever hood you represent, good in the hood. I know it's a lot of bad out there, but good, guess what? It's a lot of good, too. Yeah, check it.
Picking up cars, going to bars, getting drunk, trying to fight everybody, just talking junk.
Everybody ain't
walking around with baggy jeans, being mean and the lips purple cause we smoking trees.
Everybody ain't
trying to be tough and violent. Matter of fact, I knew some cats from the hood played the violin.
Everybody downtown,
don't frown cause you around. Just because you wear a suit don't mean we think you a clown.
So craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made. Or how a wooden table is built, piece by piece. And in not-so-small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Bob Maravich is calling in. Bob, how you doing?
Good, John. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
By way of introduction, Bob is editor of the Journal of Gospel Music, which is a very detailed resource on the web that you guys should go check out. Bob is also the author of A City Called Heaven, Chicago and the Birth of Gospel Music, which is a very comprehensive history of gospel in the city of Chicago, and also The Gospel According to Malico, which has extensive song notes about many of the important records on that record label. So Bob's been doing this for a minute and has a lot to say about gospel music history, which is why I wanted you to be here, because I think especially Kanye is such a kind of electrifying and in some circles radioactive subject and person that I think it's easy to think that what Kanye is doing by turning to religious music exists in its own ecosystem and in a vacuum. But by no means is that the case. There is a long history of artists who were well known in secular spaces turning to gospel or going back and forth between the two. So what I was hoping we could talk about is a little bit of that long history. I know you listened to the record and taken in the movie, and then we can talk later about how what Kanye is doing maybe fits into that tradition or doesn't.
Well, you know, one of the things about artists going from secular to gospel, the African American church has been one of the best music schools in the African American community. And so a lot of these artists came out of the church, went into jazz, R&B, soul, pop music, and then went back, some to stay and some not to stay. I mean, one of the classic examples is Little Richard, who, you know, great rock and roll singer, and all of a sudden just sort of dropped into gospel just almost overnight, where he started recording gospel and became a minister. But one of the stories that I think is most classic is a gentleman by the name of Arnold Dwight Gatemouth Moore, who was an R&B singer in the 40s, a recording artist, and he was on the stage of the Club DeLisa in Chicago one night, ready to do a regular performance, and he just couldn't sing his songs. He just started singing Shine On Me, which is an old camp meeting song, and the audience sort of thought that was odd. And he had his religious conversion right on stage. He ran out of the Club DeLisa and out into the snowy street and never looked back. He became an assistant minister. He made a couple of several gospel records. And so you've got those examples. And then people like Al Green, who have gone from secular into gospel. And now, as a pastor, he'll still do concerts with his hit songs, but he might sing Amazing Grace, you know, on stage as well.
And again, the point that you brought up right off the rip, which is that the church is really the training school for generations of young black musicians, singers, arrangers, musicians, so on and so forth.
Exactly. Aretha Franklin is a great example. I mean, we knew Aretha Franklin from her great Atlantic Records soul singles, but she started out singing for the church, and she went right back to the church for her Amazing Grace album and, you know, did another gospel album, but never really left the church. You know, in the West African cosmology, I'm going to drop a little science here. If you look at where enslaved Africans came from originally, the West African countries, the cosmology there was really no difference between sacred and secular music. The same music that you use to praise the gods one day, you might use to celebrate the harvest the next, or a love song, or a wedding. So the music, really, these sort of labels have been placed on it because of marketing, but also because there was a sense, particularly from the church, when gospel music started to become popular in the church, and the reason a lot of pastors didn't like it was because it sounded like this blues music and jazz, and they didn't want anything associated with what they considered as vice in their church. But the fact of the matter is, for a long time, those same rhythms, those same techniques were being used in religious worship by the descendants of enslaved Africans. So it confuses the matter, and that's why I think you get this kind of Saturday night, Sunday morning, when really it was all one and the same at one point.
When is the moment when the church starts to really say, we want to keep these influences at bay? Like, we really want to create our own safe, sacred space that is not in dialogue. Is there a particular moment when that really comes into play?
Right at the beginning of the 20th century, you had particularly the churches in the North. Back, 70 to 90 years ago, more like 90 years ago, they really favored Western European music, hymns, anthems, oratorios, because they felt to sing these old, you know, sort of folk religious songs was an embarrassing reminder of their past. It was not what somebody who was aspiring to be a middle-class assimilate into a middle-class environment would do. You need to take violin, you need to learn how to play the organ, you need how to sing these great songs by Bach and Beethoven. And there was also this sense of, I think, and I've never really seen anyone say this specifically, it's just my theory, that there was also this sense that you had for decades this minstrel show experience where the African-American lifestyle was stereotyped, and I think some people felt, well, you know, this music is being stereotyped by these minstrel shows. We want to distance ourselves from this. Anything that smacks of minstrelsy, stereotyping, that was really, I would say, from right after, maybe, let's say, late 1890s to about 1935 or so, when gospel started to make its move. And part of that really had to do with the fact that there were migrants coming from the South to the North, and they had not adopted this music of assimilationist churches. They had been singing spirituals and congregational sing-alongs. They'd been singing these old camp songs, and the rhythms were there, the improvisation was there, the falsetto was there. They came north to these churches and didn't feel quite comfortable. And because there were so many, and because they had so much political and financial potential, pastors realized soon enough, if we don't adopt this gospel music, we stand to lose our congregation.
Basically, they'll go elsewhere.
Exactly. So they were very unwilling to adjust, but they did because they realized if we don't do this, our churches may not survive.
And now, of course, this is in an era where, you know, popular music, quote unquote, as we understand it now, was not as potent a force, not quite as widespread. And it's interesting, the kind of tug of war between sacred music in a sacred context and popular music outside of that sacred context. Many people would say that popular music, from a pure scale perspective, has won over the years. But there are so many artists who work either in or near both spaces. It is still, and there are many listeners who go back and forth between the two. It's not that people are completely committed in one or the other. Fair to say?
That's absolutely fair to say. In fact, you know, there's so much that you can look at in history in terms of artists who did both. There's a woman named Mary DeLoach who was an R&B singer. She would record some gospel songs under a different name. She was actually Mary DeLoach in the gospel context, and then she had a different name in her secular context. And then you had, you know, clear borrowing, where somebody like Ray Charles got his Hallelujah, I Love Her So from a song that James Cleveland and the Gospel All-Stars recorded in 1953 called That's Why I Love Him So. I mean, if you listen to the two songs together, you can totally see where Ray Charles just got that song full cloth. But if you listen to James Cleveland's original version, it has all the elements of, you know, small jazz combo and R&B and rock and roll, and everything is in that as well. So everyone's borrowing from each other.
We should actually listen to a little bit of that James Cleveland song.
Oh, sure.
Just to underscore this point that you're making.
Let me tell you about a friend I know. He goes with you everywhere you go. And when you're down, he'll
pick you up.
You have to drink.
A lot of times people think of gospel as maybe, you know, if you're thinking in terms of like blood donors, it's a donor, but maybe not a recipient. But that has really not been the case. You talk about music of James Cleveland embracing all these other things that were happening out in the world of music at the time. And that's right up until the present day, gospel music engaging with contemporary R&B, pop structures, hip hop elements, so on and so forth. Gospel may seem from the outside to be a cloistered ecosystem, but it's not. From a listening perspective, it's not a cloistered ecosystem.
That is absolutely correct. And it has never really separated itself from that. Whatever is the current popular music of the day in the African-American community, that's what gospel sort of built as its firmament. So if it was Thomas Dorsey in the 30s, he was borrowing from classic blues and jazz. All into the swing era of the 40s, you hear artists like Sister Rosetta Tharpe working with Lucky Millinder and having small trios back her on her songs. To the 50s, where they adopted doo-wop. Well, there was sort of a synergistic sense with doo-wop, but they were borrowing back and forth. To this day, when people ask me, where do you see gospel music going in the future, I just said, follow the current popular music of the African-American community, and wherever it's going, gospel will go, because it has always tried, it's really its philosophy, never really written this way, but was always to try to bring people into the message through a medium that is comfortable and familiar. And, you know, so if it's hip-hop, that's the way to do it. If it's contemporary choirs, that's the way to do it. And that's gospel's philosophy since the very beginning.
To speak a little bit more specifically about what Kanye is doing, I have some questions about, you know, we were talking about Little Richard earlier, and obviously, you know, Aretha was so powerful in both sacred and secular spaces. Now, at the time that they were at their sort of peak of popularity, when they would toggle between the two, were they received with skepticism on either side of the divide?
Yes, I think Aretha maybe got less of it, although I know she got her fair share, but absolutely did. The church has always been more accepting of artists who come into gospel music than those who leave. So Etta James was singing with the choir in Los Angeles when she left and tried to sing gospel, and people were saying, well, you're no Mahalia Jackson. Or Sam Cooke, I mean, people felt like they had been broken up with when Sam Cooke left gospel to go pop. Lou Rawls the same way. There was always that sense of you've left us, you've abandoned us for the pop world. And so, yes, there's always been skepticism when artists come in to gospel. Even today, you'll see, even somebody like a Smokey Robinson will make a gospel album. And so the gospel enthusiasts and church folk will be like, well, how long is he going to stay with this? How does this sound? And it's a real tricky thing. I really get a sense that Kanye West is experiencing right now. It's this sort of sense of, what's this all about? How long are you going to stay? How serious are you about this? And then if you leave, if you make your name in gospel and you leave, then it's a terrific breakup. They sort of feel like you've backslid.
But then an interesting thing that has also happened, I've noticed in a couple of cases, and I'm thinking, I think Fantasia maybe, Kenny Lattimore, R&B singers who are aging out of the youthful R&B generation sometimes have turned to gospel for what may or may not be a soft landing, you know? And I wonder how artists like that are received.
And mixed. I mean, I think some have been received better than others. I think Fantasia was, there's always initial skepticism. But then it's just like any person who steps in a church to sing a song, the church is going to want to really see you succeed, and if you really turn out the house, as they would say, you're in. And so if you can really sing and you can really show genuine emotion, you'll be accepted. I've always said that there is no audience like a gospel audience that can sniff out a phony. They'll know if the person's being genuine or not. And so some of the artists who really do express their genuine Christianity that they perhaps have grown up with their whole life and they just chose to go into gospel for this album, but, has sort of been singing in the church and pop music their whole life, they'll know it. Whitney Houston's a great example. I mean, she grew up in the gospel church. She expressed that when she sang songs that were religious in nature, and people knew it. She knew her conviction was there. If there's somebody who's just sort of playing around, thinking that this might be a way to resuscitate their career, the gospel community will figure out pretty fast if they're fake.
The humility that would be required to basically go and ask to be accepted in the gospel music industry, community, so on and so forth. A lot of folks who have experienced big success in other spaces might not even be able just to get over that initial hump of saying, I humble myself to be a part of your small, smaller or this ecosystem that has its own rules, basically. That would be just even walking in the front door would be a disqualifier for, 80% of people who wanted to try.
Exactly. Yeah. They look at that group of church mothers in the front row, and if that doesn't scare them, they're either going to stay or they're going to run out that back door and say, I am so sorry, I made a mistake. But, it's a humbling experience indeed. And I really do think that's what I'm hearing with Kanye West right now.
So tell me about that. I know you've listened to the record. And just as an observer watching this whole thing unfold, whether it's the Sunday service thing, events that have been happening over the last few months, or the album and film, what are you seeing that's resonating for you, even in the art or in the messaging?
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, when I heard the album, to me, it's holy hip hop. It's Lecrae, it's Trip Lee, it's along those lines. However, the first thing I thought of after I listened to the album was I thought of Michael Jordan when here's a superstar basketball player, and then he goes to play baseball for
right.
a team in Birmingham, Alabama. And, he just can't do the same kind of things. He's really got to learn. And that was sort of like, this is Kanye West. It's a decent first effort, but he is not quite yet at the level of confidence and strength as a, Trip Lee or Lecrae or Canton Jones.
Oh, Canton Jones. Shout out Canton Jones. Great, great artist.
Yes.
Great
and, artist. And these guys, I mean, if you talk to them, I've always said that the holy hip hop artists like Canton Jones and Lecrae are sort of like the street corner evangelists of the 21st century. These guys are committed to Christianity. They're, first of all, they're some of the nicest people you'll ever talk to. And secondly, they are warriors for this. They are absolutely 100% committed. And I feel, when I listen to Jesus is King, that this is Kanye West saying, oh boy, here I go. I'm sticking my foot in the water and seeing what's happening. I know it's coming. You know, he talks about loneliness. He talks about being judged and people not accepting him, and those are all legitimate concerns. And so this would be kind of like, I'm going to try. And I think they would say, okay, it's a good try. You're not quite there yet, but it's a good start. You're moving in the right direction.
And you feel that way from the specifics of the message, of the lyrics, the kind of intensity of the praise, basically. You're saying it's not quite at the level that other gospel rappers have already like kind of perfected.
Right, because what I hear in the lyrics is really somebody who's still struggling with his own path. I mean, you know,
yes.
he recognizes, oh my gosh, you know, I'm jumping into this. This is my Christian belief. But at the same time, he's not ready to become an evangelist. So he's sort of on the mourner's bench right now, to use a church analogy, where he's singing these songs. He wants to be accepted for this. He has got there's biblical messages in here. You know, he sings, every knee shall bow, every tongue. So he knows the Bible, and in the film, there's, you know, biblical references throughout, even though the film is such a very different animal. But it's about him. This album is still about him, and I think for him to get into the league of the holy hip-hop stars, he has to turn it to where it's, I'm saved, and now I'm going to save you. And it's got to take the focus off of him and give more energy to the people he's saving. Now, maybe Jesus is born at Christmas, if that happens, is going to be the place that it happens, but I think he's still struggling right now.
But I'm so glad that you nailed that, because the thing that I was actually most struck by on Jesus is King was how much it sounded like a normal Kanye West record. And it's kind of an unpopular thing to say, because I think the kind of like knee-jerk top-line way to look at this is, you know, Kanye's had a couple of difficult years in public life. He's re-entrenching himself in Black music, in the Black community, in a heritage that he has maybe walked away from somewhat. That's kind of the easy read of what he's doing here. But the more I listened to Jesus is King, the more I felt like this sounds like a Kanye album. This sounds like a 2005 Kanye album, a 2008 Kanye record. And now, obviously, are there references to biblical passages? Yes. Like, is there some of the thematic work more overtly about being saved or looking to be saved? Absolutely. But these are also things that Kanye has reckoned with, you know, at varying levels throughout his entire career. And what you just pointed out, that him being at the center of the narrative on this record, is not a disqualifier, but it shows that he's still like kind of in on first base, basically. He's not, you know, he hasn't rounded the bases yet.
That's exactly right. That's
yeah. And he has not arrived at like the full, it is now my mission to save you. He's not there.
He's not there yet. He's still a little self-conscious about his new role. I mean, now, interestingly, the film is almost, it is really a different animal. I mean, this is basically his choir. They're a good choir. They're directed well, and they tend to incorporate, if not outright sing, songs that I'm sure Kanye West grew up with in Chicago. I mean, these were, you know, songs that, you know, what I heard was, so I was like, Perfect Praise, How Excellent. That's Walt
Whitman. Yes, How Excellent, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, he heard that. There's Walter Hawkins. I heard Andre Crouch's Hallelujah. Ricky Dillard's More Abundantly, that Sonya Whitmore wrote. These are all songs that were like in the bloodstream. I mean, even if he didn't go to church on Sunday, and I don't get the impression he was a terrible big churchgoer, but you turn the radio on Sunday morning in Chicago, Illinois, back in the 80s, and you were going to hear these songs. You're going to hear them in school. You're going to hear them all over the place. He grew up with those songs. And so this is, the film sort of struck me as this very reverent, you know, it's open, each section opens with a biblical passage. It's very avant-garde, very experimental in the imaging.
Right. But, structurally, yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But the music is straight up Chicago, south side of Chicago, west side of Chicago, gospel choir in every church. This is what you heard. This was church gospel.
The standards. Those are the standards.
Exactly. Yeah. So this was a different thing. And then he comes in sort of at the end and he sings, you know, what's that, Streetlights, kind of an acoustic way. And that's about his role in the film. So there was a little bit more confidence in his not being present, sort of showing off what his choir can do. And then on his album, you know, the choir's role is much limited, and it's really more him talking about this sort of being in the middle of this journey where he's still unsure. It's this darkness is still all around. He's not seeing the light yet. He's not, you know, he's not saved yet.
And that's fascinating because I do think that the tension between the film and the album is on the album, he is the central proposition. But in the film, he's not. I was really struck by how little Kanye West is in the film. And I think, obviously, it's his baby, right? You know, it doesn't exist without him. But in almost every moment that he is in the film, he is off to the side. He is doing something that's not the central proposition, which is highlighting this choir singing this music. Now, there is this kind of signature Kanye West gesture of taking something like the gospel standards he might have heard in the 80s growing up and putting them in this avant context, relocating them into, you know, the Rodin Crater, you know, into James Turrell's great land artwork, you know, filming them in a way that gospel choirs are not ordinarily filmed, dressing them in a way that gospel choirs do not ordinarily dress. This is a sort of signature Kanye West juxtaposition of different, you know, creative influences coming from different places and him patching them all together. That's something you really get in the film that I think you don't get in the album.
Even in the album, I mean, they quote a little bit from Jeffrey LaVallee's Revelation 19 on Selah, but then this one, Follow God, where it's this kind of independent record from Memphis by a group called Whole Truth that you have to be a hardcore collector to even know about when he samples Can You Lose by Following God, which I'm sure Whole Truth is delighted that this happened. But wow, I mean, that was really quite an obscure reference, you know, but Revelation 19 would have fit in the movie too. And then, of course, there's a little bit of Crouch's Hallelujah on the CD. But yeah, other than that, it really is more like a Kanye West album. Him trying to assemble all of his components, his producers and his influences to say, you know, I'm just about ready to step out on the water and who knows what's going to happen next. But he's still, this is the beginning of his journey. Whether he'll stay, I don't know. You know, he does talk about, I think it was the song on, it was one of the songs on the album where he talks about how expensive it is. Oh, on God, I think how expensive it is to be in music and how much you have to pay. Well, the problem with gospel music is it is not a very lucrative, financially lucrative place to be. So, I mean, if he gives it all up to follow Jesus, well, I mean, he's going to be living an entirely different life. So
he might not give up the sneakers.
Exactly.
He might give up the secular music, but he might not give up the sneakers.
Exactly.
That's $150 million he's walking away from.
Exactly, exactly. You know, and that's the thing is my guess, if I had to look out into the future, is that I could see him going back into the secular world of hip-hop, maybe altering the language, maybe it's more inspirational, maybe it's pretty clean language, and there might be a song or two on each album, like Al Green did. You know, every album's going to have one or two songs that are going to be Christian-focused, but he's not going to give it all up. And I actually don't think the gospel community would have a problem with that. You know, the gospel community, as far as I could tell, I'm just sort of sniffing around this weekend. It's a disappointment in this album. I'm saying I don't understand why. I mean, the movie was surprising to me, but the album was absolutely not surprising to me. I expected a kind of a holy hip-hop sound, so I think maybe there were folks that thought he was going to do like what Snoop Dogg did, which is to really get into the gospel music and, you know, be kind of the MC and that sort of thing. No, this is Kanye West doing what he does and expected this, and he's using the lyrics to express his messaging in the Christian world. So
And just to mention the Snoop thing, that was a recent project that Snoop put out. I'm trying to remember the name of the album.
It was Bible of Love or something like that.
Yeah, explain to people what that album was like and how it sort of functions different than this record.
it was really Snoop Dogg really exposing, I guess you'd say, his audience to contemporary gospel music, really church gospel. I always say there's a difference between church gospel and radio gospel. Radio gospel can sometimes be very commercial, you know, dedicated to radio listening, versus church gospel is a song you would hear in church. And what Snoop Dogg gave were songs that he sang in church. I mean, I think he dedicated it to his grandmother, so there was this familial thing going on. And he really was paying tribute to these roots of gospel music that he grew up with. And, you know, he had some of the biggest superstars in gospel music to contribute to this. So it really wasn't, it was sort of like, it might have been Snoop Dogg Presents, because he barely shows up on there. Where here, really, the only two gospel sort of presences on Jesus is King would be Fred Hammond.
Yes.
Who wasn't used
very... vocally processed Fred Hammond.
Yeah, I didn't think they used Fred at all well in that. And then, of course, you have Warren Campbell, whose wife is one of Mary, Erica Campbell. And actually, I have to say that one song that's on the album that I think Warren produces is, I think, the best song, as far as I'm concerned, God is, as far as a song that could make gospel charts. Actually, I'd say probably none of these songs will, but if one had the opportunity, it would probably be God Is, because it sounds like a James Cleveland song updated.
Let's listen to a bit of God Is.
Portions. I know I won't forget all he's done. He's the strength in this race that I run. Every time I look up, I see God's faithfulness, and it shows just how much he is miraculous. I can't keep it to myself, I can't sit here and be still. Everybody I will tell, till the whole world is healed. King of kings, Lord of lords, he has in store. From the rich to the poor, all are welcome through the door. You won't ever be the same when you call on Jesus' name. Listen to the words I'm saying, Jesus saved me, now I'm saying. And I know God is the force that picked me up. I know Christ is the...
I know Follow God is getting more of the likes, or, you know, people are talking about that, but I actually think God Is probably the one true kind of church gospel song on there. So that's the difference, you know, between
those two. And I wonder, from a musical perspective, you know, we talked a little bit about the lyrics. From a musical perspective, does the music on this record sound like it could go hand in hand with any gospel music, gospel rap, anything from the last 5 to 10 years? Like, does it feel simpatico with people who are working heavily in that space, or does it feel like it's kind of, you know, spaceshipping in from somewhere else and kind of like getting coded in gospel signifiers, but not really otherwise?
No, it absolutely sounds, I mean, when I first heard it, that's holy hip hop. It's like Sir the Baptist, if you listen to his music, Mr. Dell, who used to be in the 3-6 Mafia, he's now saved, and Show Baraka. This album sort of fits in the middle. He's not at the Canton Jones and Lecrae level yet, but he's not at the, you know, the independent artist, holy hip-hop person who is just struggling. He's sort of in the middle there right now, trying to eke his way up the ladder. If you put this album in a holy hip-hop show on the internet, it would totally fit in.
Okay, so it's not a complete outlier from that perspective, because I sometimes wonder, when I was listening to this, you know, Kanye's textures are so specific. And even when I've listened to gospel rap, or like some of the more adventurous, you know, gospel, you know, like a Ty Tribbett or someone like that, the textures are not quite the same as what you would have coming out of the hip hop world. They're analogous, but maybe not exactly lining up. And so, but you think that there's more in common there, maybe, than not.
There's more in common there than not. Absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of internet radio shows that have holy hip hop as their focus, and they could drop these songs right in there. With maybe one or two exceptions, and they would totally fit in the flow.
Bob, I appreciate you taking the time to educate us on the long history of artists going back and forth between these two spaces. And I think Kanye is going to be an interesting test case, because I think he was always maybe 5 to 10% thinking about these things. And now it's interesting to see him give kind of a, full attention to them. And we'll see. Maybe we'll circle back in a year and be like, wasn't that a strange trip?
Exactly. Definitely. Yeah. Do the post game.
Exactly. No, we might have to do that in 12 months. Thank you so much again. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me on.
As we're going out, I know we opened with Use This Gospel, which is one of my favorite songs on the record, and I think is really one of the most powerful ones as well. One of the reasons it's powerful is because it does that signature Kanye thing of juxtaposing unlikely partners, as Bob and I were just talking about. So we opened with the beginning part of Use This Gospel, where you hear Kanye singing, maybe timidly, a little bit meekly, but in a very kind of undeniable Kanye Westian way. But then something interesting happens in that song, which is that the clips show up. There are good bars from both Pusha and No Malice. So let's listen to a little bit of the clips as we're going out. And then the clips, as I'm sure if you've been on the internet any time in the last few days, gives way to a beatific Kenny G solo. So let's ride out on that. That is our show. Thank you to Hassan James. Check out Rue Magazine. Thank you to Bob Maravich. Check out the Journal of Gospel Music and his book, A City Called Heaven, Chicago and the Birth of Gospel Music. Listen to every podcast ever, nytimes.com/podcast. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Stitcher, Apple Podcast apps, et cetera, et cetera. And email us. I'm actually really curious. I feel like the energy on the recent Kanye West stuff is really all over the place. So I'd love to hear from folks, especially folks who are religiously inclined, how this all feels to them. Email me at podcast@nytimes.com. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back ASAP.